So as I said earlier, I goobered up this Dharma talk on very short notice. So we'll see how that goes. I scribbled down some notes. I'll see if I can read them. And I want to start by saying that at Marin Sangha, our central idea is Dharma in the daily life. We're not doing this to become expert meditators, and we're not doing this to become experts on Buddhist teachings. We're doing this to become better people, to find more freedom in our lives, and to open ourselves at least to the possibility of full liberation. So I bring that up because tonight the talk that I'm about to give is really not going to have anything to do with Dharma in your daily life. So if you came here for that, my apologies in advance. This is more of a Dharma entertainment, or a dharmically flavored entertainment. So I've given it a sensationalist title, and the title is Who Killed the Buddha? I hope that's enticement enough. If there were cars back then, there would be car chases. There aren't, because there weren't. So how did this get started, this idea for this talk? A couple of years ago, actually more like 8 or 10 years ago, someone asked me, was the Buddha a vegetarian? And I gave an answer that was pretty stock at the time, more on that. And I said, no, he was not a vegetarian, and in fact, he died from eating bad pork. And then just a little while later, a friend pulled me aside and said, you know, there's some scholarship now that has proven that he didn't die from eating bad pork. It was from eating bad mushrooms. So I went, So, now, in my defense, I think even today, if you went to Sri Lanka or to Thailand or Burma and asked your average monk or nun how the Buddha died, they'd probably say, oh, he died from eating bad pork. So it's still sort of a central part of the story of the Buddha's life in our lineage. And I think you'd get the same answer in Tibet, or in any Zen monastery, even in Japan. But I was kind of interested in this idea of, you know, how the Buddha dies. So I did some research using that wonderful resource, the internet. And I found the paper that makes the argument that the Buddha died from eating mushrooms rather than pork. So, you know, we're digging here into dietary information that believe me, we're getting to the murder mystery later on. This gets more exciting. So the mushroom theory has the paper had sort of three basic approaches. One was to talk a lot about the medicinal properties of one particular kind of mushroom, and it struck me as being arm-waving. It didn't really advance the argument. The second one was that the translation, the Pali phrase that describes the Buddha's last meal is usually translated as tasty pork. But it turns out, according to this argument, that it could also be translated as pig's delight. That is, delicious pig could also be interpreted as being delicious for the pig, not just delicious from the pig. So, okay, I don't know Pali that well, so I will set that argument aside. The third argument was that the householder who served the Buddha his last meal, his name was Kunha, and he was not in the Brahmin caste, he was in a lower caste. And the argument is that Kunha would never have served pork to the Buddha because this violated caste rules. Now, I don't buy this argument at all for several reasons. The Buddha was born a Brahmin, but he had rejected the caste system, at least within his community. He didn't try to bring down the caste system, by the way. But if you joined the Buddha's Sangha, if you joined the community of followers, you left your caste behind. which makes it kind of unthinkable today because Indians are much more touchy about caste than they were 2,500 years ago. One of the big reasons for the great 1857 rebellion against the British was the notion that the British were trying to break caste. Break caste was a phrase used by the Indian nationalists. So the other thing about this is that the document that we know today as sort of the list of rules for castes, and it's very long, very elaborate, it's called the Laws of Manu, and it was first written down in the first century BC. So it's been around for a while. It's very detailed and quite oppressive, in my opinion. The Buddha died 300 or 400 years, depending on what scholar you listen to, before that document was written down. And we know that, I think we can assume that the rules were far less onerous and far less formalized 300 or 400 years beforehand. And in fact, the Buddha grew up in a part of India where the caste system had not really caught on. I think everybody believed in rebirth, to some extent at least, but the idea that you were born into a caste because your parents were in that caste, it was widely adopted and was growing, but it was not adopted everywhere. It wasn't enforced everywhere. So I think it could be true, but I tend to doubt that, this whole business about kunha not being allowed to serve pork to the Buddha. But anyway, this is kind of interesting. When I did this research, I turned up some other interesting tidbits. And one of these is that somebody actually went through the entire Pali Canon and found every description of a meal that the Buddha ate. Now, I think some scholar deserves a purple heart for doing that kind of research. I mean, that just stuns me that somebody would actually do that. They found 14 meals described. This includes his final meal. So 13 other meals. And of those, 12 of those meals are unambiguously vegetarian in name. And the 13th, there's actually a story around it. And that is that the Buddha accepted meat in a meal that was offered to him, but he accepted it because he did not want to embarrass his host. Which I think is fascinating because he could have been a vegetarian. The rules did not forbid him from being a vegetarian, and more about that in a few minutes. But it meant that even if he was a vegetarian, maintaining the honor of his host was more important to him than his dietary preferences, which to me is just another demonstration of the enormous generosity of the Buddha. So, among the characters that I want to introduce, one is the Vinaya. The Vinaya is the first collection in the Sutta-Pitaka. Tipitaka, which we call the Pali Canon. The Tipitaka, and the word Tipitaka basically means three baskets. Tipitaka. Pitaka means basket. It's sometimes used as three heaps. So they both work. So the first one is the Vinaya, which is actually a collection of, I think, 7 different books. They're quite long. The Vinaya is a really interesting collection because it is the rules. Essentially, it's the rules for the monastic order. And it seems like 7 big books is really excessive for that, right? Because there are a couple of hundred rules for male monastics, and 800-odd rules for female monastics, which is highly unfair if that's the way it was. But you'd think that you could get them all on about 3 or 4 sheets of paper, bulleted itemed, with, you know, 11-point Times New Roman font. But instead you get these big books. And part of this is there are a lot of other stories involved besides this, but for every rule, there's a story. And these stories are wonderful little glimpses into the life of the Sangha 2,500 years ago. So it's a wonderful collection. And interestingly, the Vinaya and the Sutta-Pitaka, the basket of suttas, which is the Buddha's discourses, and some other material, were passed down orally for a number of centuries before they were finally written down. And they started writing them down in Sri Lanka, in the language Pali, in the first century BC. And the first collection they wrote down wasn't the Buddha's teachings, it was the Vinaya, the rules of the monastic order. They put a higher priority on that than on the Buddha's teachings. Although they got around to those pretty quickly. So the Vinaya has a lot of interesting rules. And stories about how the rules were formed. Because the Buddha and his community were making it up as they went along. Literally. They weren't copying other rules of other other groups that went around, you know, mendicant groups. They were making it up as they went along. So two monks would go to the Buddha and say, the Buddha would say, okay, from now on, here's a rule covering this situation. So, and nicely, he never did ex post facto. He never said, okay, but I'm going to punish you because you violated the rule before I created the rule. You know, he never did that. And he would sometimes amend or even change the rules or drop them if some new case came up that pointed out flaws in the logic of the old rule. Very interesting watching how this developed over time. Also, interestingly, when the Buddha died, he said, you know, there's a whole bunch of rules. You don't have to keep them all. Just keep the important ones. And so they argued for a long time about what rules were important and what rules were not. And they finally said, nah, the hell with this. Let's just keep them all. So there's a bunch of interesting rules about food in the Vinaya. And one of them, you know, as you probably know, monks and nuns go out and collect food in the morning, and whatever they collect, they can eat as long as they eat it before noon, and they can't save it overnight, which, given the climate in India, is probably a pretty good idea. You would not trust that food the next day. And you accept the food that's given to you. And I'm assuming that you didn't necessarily have to eat it if you didn't like it or didn't want it. But you could not accept meat that had been killed for you. You had to accept meat if it had not been explicitly killed for you. And because this is a little confusing, it's as if Farmer Brown comes up to you, you're a monk, and it's, you know, 450 BC or so, 500 BC, you're a monk, you're standing there with a bowl, and Farmer Brown comes up with a bunch of fried chicken. And he says, this is leftovers from celebrating Cousin Bubba's birthday this morning. So here, have some. And okay, you smile and you accept the fried chicken. But if Farmer Brown comes up and says, here, we killed the old rooster because we knew you guys were coming to town, you have to refuse the food. Which is kind of an odd little legalism when you think about it, that some meat is okay and other meat is not okay depending on the intention of the person who killed the animal. And it's kind of weird when you think about it. That's kind of, to me, hair-splitting. There's another problem that I haven't heard anybody bring up, and that is that it gives kind of a mixed message about right livelihood. Because there are some rules about, you know, right livelihood is one of the folds in the Eightfold Path. And right livelihood, there's a list, several lists, in the suttas about what constitutes right livelihood and what's not. For instance, it's not okay to be an arms dealer. It's not okay to deal in slaves. It's not okay to sell booze. And, very specifically, it's not okay to deal in animals raised for slaughter. So you're accepting food from that is, in a way, tainted by a lack of right livelihood. And yet, this is not banned. Now, it turns out that this caused some serious controversy in the Sangha. And I'm going to start talking about that. But I want to introduce another character, and his name is Devadatta. Devadatta is both the Buddha's cousin and his brother-in-law. Complicated? Well, these clan relationships were indeed very complicated. And so you run into this kind of relationship very often. And it turns out that Devadatta was also, is said to have been the brother of Ananda. And Ananda, I'll be talking more about Ananda specifically because I want to give him the introduction that is his due. So Devadatta joined the Buddha pretty early on, and he meditated hard, and he had a lot of attainments as a meditator, and he was said to have great psychic power. And after a while, he sort of started to resent the Buddha. He felt that he was just as entitled to be regarded as a great spiritual teacher as the Buddha. He was a dharmic big shot, just like the Buddha. Why not? So he started doing some kind of egotistical things. And I won't go into all of them. He did some conspiracy stuff with the son of a local king. The conspiracy sort of failed, but one of the things he did early was he actually went to the Buddha and encouraged the Buddha to retire. He said, look, you've been working hard. You've been, you know, running this big sangha, making up the rules and teaching all the time. Why don't you take it easy and let somebody like me run the sangha for you? You can be our honored leader emeritus. And the Buddha would have none of that. So then Devadatta actually did 3 assassination attempts on the Buddha. And the first one was quite elaborate. He set up this conspiracy where there are a bunch of people who would go kill the Buddha, and then he would arrange to have them killed so that they could never talk, and then have those people killed in turn, you know, one of those pyramid scams of death. And but the people who went to kill the Buddha just lost interest in it and couldn't do it. So his next attempts were, I think, less colorful. He rolled some rocks down on the Buddha from above, but the Buddha somehow evaded them or magically deflected them. I'm not sure what the story is. In the third attempt, he actually got a mad elephant to charge the Buddha. But the elephant was so charmed by the Buddha that he gave up and was, I guess, friendly with the Buddha. So he gave up trying to kill the Buddha. This was not panning out. But one of the things that Devadatta thought he could do better than the Buddha was he felt that the monks and nuns were getting too cushy a deal, that they were really living the posh lifestyle, but they could actually sleep under roofs, they were allowed to eat meat, they didn't have to do anything ascetic. You know, they couldn't, you know, from our point of view, they had it pretty tough. They couldn't own anything except medicine, the bowl they begged in, the robes they wore, and a spare pair of robes. That was it. They couldn't own anything. They couldn't eat anything after noon. They couldn't touch money. There were all these rules that they had to follow. But that was enough for Devadatta. He was hardcore. So he was always grumbling with his pals in the sangha. And there were a lot of people who looked up to him, obviously. He was a slick talker. So there were a lot of other people who were grumbling along with Devadatta. And finally Devadatta figured, well, you know, I'm not going to get rid of the Buddha. I'm not going to take over the Sangha. What I can do is just get everybody to leave, or get a whole bunch of people to leave. So one day he said to all of his followers, his cohort, his posse, he said, let's go down the road a little ways and we'll just start our own Sangha. And sooner or later, the Buddha's going to realize that he's got to catch up with the modern times. He's got to snap out of it and admit he's wrong and join us. So he got a whole bunch of people. I think the story is that there were 500 of them. They went down the road, and they sat down, and they all patted themselves on the back. And as they were sitting there, somebody looked down the road and they saw 2 monks coming down the road. And this is time to introduce Sariputta and Moggallana. Sariputta and Moggallana were the Buddha's closest followers. They were so close that, in fact, he often, because he was fairly old by now, and he had bad knees and a bad back, sometimes he felt so bad that he would ask either Moggallana or Sariputta to give a talk in his stead. So he'd say, I'm not feeling so good. Sariputta, could you give a talk? And Sariputta would give a talk. And then afterwards, the Buddha would say, I'm the Buddha and I approve this message. So that occurs a couple times in the suttas. So if you were a betting person back then, and you were wondering what would happen after the Buddha died, you would be willing to bet money that Sariputta or Moggallana or the both of them would be the successor who would take over running the Sangha after the death of the Buddha. They were the obvious choice. They were his most trusted followers. So those two monks coming down that dusty road from the Buddha's encampment to Devadatta's encampment, who were they? It was Sariputta and Moggallana. So of course, Devadatta says, wow, if those guys are coming down the road to join us, that means that the Buddha's really stuck now. It means his two most loyal, devoted followers have abandoned him. He'll have to settle with us now. He's really got no choice. This is great. We've won. So Sariputta and Moggallana show up. They sit down. There's the usual exchange of formal pleasantries. Hello, how are you doing? And then Devadatta makes a serious mistake. He invites one of the two, I think it's Sariputta, to give a talk. And then Devadatta goes to take a nap. So Sariputta talks to the 500, however many there were, and he says, well, you know, come on, guys. The Buddha, he's the guy who really started this. He taught you everything you know. He's a good, come on back. He won't hold it against you. All is forgiven. Everything will be okay. Come on. And the most of the monks, they were going, yeah, you're right. And they nudged him, yeah. And so they sort of felt some regret, some remorse, and they all got up and went back with Sariputta and Moggallana back to where the Buddha was. So Devadatta, when he wakes up, he looks around and there's nobody there. Rats. So the story goes that he was going back towards the Buddha's encampment for some reason, and he was swallowed up into a hell realm. But I think that unlikely, and in fact, well, more about this later. I'm going to keep Devadatta around as a villain because he's really good at it. Yeah, and it's important for the story to have a particular villain. And more on this later. So the scene changes. I'm going to talk completely about the death of the Buddha. And the story of the death of the Buddha is told in the Parinibbana Sutta, which happens to be the longest sutta in the entire Pali Canon. It's also extremely detailed, which is kind of useful for us, as you'll see. It's the story of the Buddha's death. And it starts out, Buddha is in the boonies. Now, there's some scholarship recently that questions this, that says that the area he was traveling in was actually pretty important. But it's been believed for a long time, until this more recent scholarship, that he was in kind of an unimportant area. And that he had a very small entourage, not a lot of people with him. Which is very odd, because here he was, the leader of a movement with tens of thousands of followers all over northern India. In fact, the movement had grown so much, there were a lot of people who had never seen the Buddha talk. They had learned from people who had learned from people who had learned from the Buddha. He'd actually been checking up on this, too. There's one of the suttas. he meets a young man, a young monk, who's on his way to meet the Buddha. And the Buddha doesn't identify himself, but instead he asks, well, you know, what did this Buddha guy say about? And then he asks the young man, and the young man repeats one of the Buddha's teachings. And the Buddha says, yeah, good job. You remembered. And by the way, that's me. I'm the Buddha. And so I think a lot of people interpret this as the Buddha sort of checking up, making sure that his teachings are being transmitted accurately. One of the people in that entourage is worth introducing now, and that's Ananda. Ananda was a brother-in-law of the Buddha. No?
Well, there's so much contradictory stuff about Ananda. You might as well just take whatever story you want, but let people know that they all can't be true. Otherwise, he would have had to be simultaneously about 5 years old and about 40 at the same time. And so, and brother-in-law is probably what the tradition was then was to try to make up as many relationships as possible between cousins. So Devadatta had to be his brother, he had to be his brother-in-law,
right.
And they all had to be born on the same day. And so you can kind of pick and choose and take it all with a grain of salt.
Well, let's just say that Ananda was a relative of the Buddha, and it is said to be brother of Devadatta. I got this off of a Wikipedia page, so it mustn't be true. So Ananda was the Buddha's personal attendant for a long time. Not for the whole teaching career of the Buddha, but certainly for a very long time. And Ananda was widely known in the community as being scrupulously honest and reliable. And he was known for his phenomenal memory. Now, we have to keep in mind that this is an oral culture. Writing was just starting up, and most people didn't read or write. Reading or writing, a king might have a scribe hired. We know that writing, when started in the Fertile Crescent, was first used for taxation purposes, was done only for tracking property and for property boundaries and such. And it's very likely that was the treatment of the very earliest writing in the northern India. And in fact, we don't have any reference to writing at all from northern India until much later, during the reign of King Ashoka, which is roughly 250 BC, so long after the death of the Buddha. So we have no reference to writing or evidence of writing at all up until the reign of Ashoka. And oral traditions, oral peoples, have memories that are quite astonishing to those of us who are used to being able to jot things down and write shopping lists. There are stories of translations of Hamlet being given, three-hour play being performed for Bushmen, who then are able to quote lines from anywhere in the play, recite the whole play. Or there are people who were oral culture people who were taken to a baseball game back in the 1920s or 30s and were able to repeat every play. And not just every substantial play, every pop-up foul, every move of the players. So all of them had memories that were far better than ours, and yet Ananda was particularly known for his memory. And when he became the Buddha's personal attendant, he did so under a couple of conditions. One was, if the Buddha gave a talk, Ananda had to be there, so he could listen and memorize the talk. Second, the Buddha had to go over all of his previous talks and teach them to Ananda so Ananda could learn them. And then there were a few other rules, but those are the ones that are most important to this story, his phenomenal memory, even by standards that we find astonishing. So there's the Buddha out in the middle of nowhere with a surprisingly small entourage. And things have been tough for the Buddha. By now, Sariputta and Moggallana had both died. They died just a few months apart. And one of them had died food poisoning. And the other had died, they'd been killed by bandits, which I find very odd. Why would bandits kill a monk? You can't exactly make your fortune robbing a monk. So this is kind of odd. And the Buddha was sick. He was in his 80s. And he had he had bad knees and a bad back, but he also had an intestinal disorder that would leave him flat on his back for days at a time. It was quite painful. So there's been some speculation that here's the Buddha in the middle of nowhere with a very small entourage, and yet he is the titular head of a very large movement. Is he being marginalized? Is the Sangha being run by some people in his absence who are sort of deliberately keeping him out of the way? Is he losing it? He's in his 80s. So this is a very interesting speculation. So now I'm going to bring up the Stephen Batchelor theory. This is a really interesting story. Stephen Batchelor brought it up in his book, Confessions of a Buddhist Atheist. And Stephen Batchelor proposes the idea, the theory, that there's actually a cabal, a small group in leadership circles of the Buddhist Sangha who are sort of running things. And it's they who have sent the Buddha off to kind of a remote area, just so that his influence is lessened. I mean, they can't get rid of him or force him to retire because he's still enormously respected. So what did they do? And who's leading them? Don't know. It couldn't be Devadatta directly, but maybe through proxies. Maybe there are people in the Sangha who are still followers of the Devadatta ideal. Don't know. But, you know, I like to think of Devadatta doing it, twirling his mustache. So we have these people who are running the Sangha. And Sariputta and Moggallana, they were the logical successors of the Buddha. So, you know, the Buddha's old, he's dying. You want to get rid of Sariputta and Moggallana if you want to take over the Sangha when the Buddha dies. So, yeah, the whole thing about the bandits, the thing about the food poisoning, maybe it's because those two have been assassinated already. So, according to the Batchelor theory, there is an assassin in the entourage, in the Buddha's entourage. Because, of course, in an entourage, there's got to be monks. But there also have to be people who sort of handle the animals, transport the food. They might have to handle money. There are probably novices and other civilians along. So, be easy to have an assassin in the entourage. So as the story goes in the Parinibbana Sutta, they're stopping at a house where they are served the midday meal. And the Buddha eats some of the food, and then he demands that the rest of the food be buried immediately and that no one else have any. And it is buried immediately. And then the Buddha, very soon after, has these terrible symptoms. He has this rectal bleeding. And he does not live long after that. So the story is that he has been poisoned, or poison was put in the food, but the Buddha was not the target. I mean, the Buddha's old. He's dying. He's sick. All the cabal would have to do is wait. And the Buddha would be out of the way. His logical successors are gone. So why do they want to take over? Because they have ideological notions that are different from the Buddha's. They want to shift the Sangha in a slightly different direction, maybe a significantly different direction. And they can't do that as long as Ananda is there. Ananda is the target. Ananda's memory is so good that if people were to say, oh, the Buddha said this, Ananda's the one who could say, no, he didn't, he said that. And everyone would trust Ananda because of the respect that he is held in by everyone throughout northern India who is a follower of the Buddha. Ananda has such respect and such trust that they cannot take over the Sangha as long as Ananda is in the way. Because Ananda will transmit accurately the Buddhist teachings. They won't be able to monkey around with them at all. So Ananda is the target. So when the Buddha perceives, however perceives it, that the food is poisoned, he takes the poison himself, just so that people don't have to take their word for it, his word for it, and then demands that it be buried. And he's doing this to protect Ananda, which means that he's doing it to protect his teachings from the corruption that would otherwise occur. So the Buddha has actually saved the Dhamma and sacrificed himself to do it. And he saved the Dhamma by saving Ananda. Now, Devadatta has one more card to play, though. And that is that the leadership of the Sangha now calls what we call today the Council of 500. And it's 500 enlightened arahants, enlightened followers of the Buddha. Now, Stephen Batchelor points out that the cave where they met is nowhere big enough to hold 500 people. Could hold maybe 30 or 40. Don't know. And maybe they had the plenary sessions in the cave and they had breakout sessions somewhere else. You know, you could think of all these enlightened people with little name tags. No, because they didn't write things down. But they had good memories. Anyway, that's kind of an aside there. Sorry about that. So there's one chance yet to silence Ananda, and that is that the Council of 500 is enlightened people only. And the odd thing about Ananda is that he's been this devoted follower of the Buddha for all these years, and yet he has never become enlightened. He's not enlightened. So the cabal is able to say, sorry, you can't come and participate in this because you're not enlightened. So that night, Ananda sits down to do some heavy-duty meditating, and he does, and he becomes enlightened. So the next morning he shows up and says he's enlightened, and I guess everybody who is enlightened is psychic enough to know when someone else is enlightened, so they let Ananda come in and participate. And what the Council of 500 does is to decide what it is that they're transmitting and set about in an organized way to memorize it and keep on presenting it over time. And what they memorized is more or less, I mean, there are bound to be corruptions, more or less what we know today as the Pali Canon, or at least the Vinaya and the Sutta Pitaka. So the hopes of that cabal, of that inner conspiratorial circle, have been dashed. But, dramatic pause here. But I found a few other interesting things when I did all that research. And one is that the Buddha did not die from poison. He didn't die from food poisoning. He did not die from bad pork or from bad mushrooms. A number of doctors have commented on this publicly over the years, that his symptoms are just not consistent with that. And this is where we get back to the detail of the Parinibbana Sutta, that the Buddha eats this food and almost immediately starts rectal bleeding, profuse rectal bleeding. There is no toxin or poison in the world that has a symptom like that. Something that powerful would cause vomiting first, Or if something attacked the intestines, it would take hours before it had any effect. But there is something that fits quite well. And in fact, I gave a clue earlier. He had this intestinal disorder. It's almost certain that he died of some kind of intestinal aneurysm. That is a tear in the intestines. It's such that that what was in the intestines, all that yucky stuff, goes into the bloodstream. And before the invention of antibiotics, this was almost invariably fatal. And in fact, even more recently, even after antibiotics, it is extremely grave, and many people who have injuries such that their intestinal wall is pierced, even now many of them, it's fatal for many. If that happens to you, it is a grave, grave situation, even today. So he died of an intestinal aneurysm. Now, maybe there was a plot to poison him. We don't know. There is no evidence. It's a speculation. It's a wonderful story, but that's all it is. And I found one other interesting thing, and that's about Devadatta. He did start his own meditation and practice community. And we know that there are references to it as late as the 400s AD. So it was a significant movement that lasted quite a long time after the death of the Buddha. In fact, when I first looked up Devadatta in Wikipedia, I found this article referred to evidences of a Devadatta community still in India in the 1800s AD. Now, the most recent article does not have that mentioned. So this is very sort of, it's a teaser. I've not been able to find any reference. So yes, there may have been some kind of community that late. It would be quite astonishing if there was, because really almost all traces of Buddhism disappeared from India by 12 or 1300. So for a Devadatta sect to persist would be pretty surprising. So that's pretty much the end of the story. As you see, it doesn't really have anything to do with your practice or mine. It is a Dharma entertainment. So do we have any questions or comments? By the way, if you want to know more about this, Barbara McHugh over here really is the expert. She's been doing a lot of research on Ananda in particular. Could we have the microphone over there?
Thank you, Bill. I love that storytelling. And I love the story. Two things come to mind for me. One, how grateful I am that the Malin Sangha and Spirit Rock have guidelines to prevent that kind of cabal and that kind of interior rebellion, that we're very blessed to have a structure here that protects our Sangha. So that made me very grateful. But second, I wanted to say, if anyone's interested in learning more about the issue of vegetarianism in the Buddha's time, there's a wonderful book by Norm Phelps called The Great Compassion. And I have a number of copies I'll bring next week. If anybody wants to borrow one, you're welcome to have it.
I've actually found a new billet. So if you, any of you want to do some research into Mahakasapa, who was the first patriarch of Buddhists, he says some of the most sexist things imaginable. In fact, at the Buddha's funeral, he came a bit late and completely denigrated Ananda for having women involved in the ceremonies and said the Buddha's corpse has been defiled. Women's tears. But that, I mean, he has a whole lot of rules. And he also did a lot of criticism of Ananda and the younger monks. The kind of, Stephen Batchelor talks about this too, so there's that other filter how you feel about Stephen Batchelor. But he talks about how the young liberals became very disaffected from Kasapa, particularly some nuns who he, one nun disrobed because she couldn't stand the man, and And she's gone now in the tradition is known as the bad nun. Bad bhikkhuni. But it's a fascinating story about how Ananda was really put to the his feet were put to the coals. I mean, he had to come up before the council, before it was even started. He was said, okay, if you come to this council, you will be the water carrier, the water boy, unless you can become enlightened. And then they made him apologize for all of these things that he really didn't do, and when he did do them, they seemed to be quite liberal and reasonable. So he was sort of humiliated, and again, there was so much sexism. Anyway, so just to give you another villain, because David Otto did seem to leave.
Right.
And it also, by the way, the mushroom dish that was fixed, you said Pig's Delight. Another translation was Hog's Mincemeat. And supposedly it was truffles, so the pigs would look for the truffles. Mm. At least that was one theory of the dish. Mm.
Right, which I find a little hard to believe because truffles don't grow very well in that kind of climate. Well, yeah, and this is controversial because, of course, Kassapa, Maha is a honorific. Maha means great. So Kassapa, Maha Kassapa is considered to be the first patriarch in Zen lineage. So portraying him as kind of a villain is very, very controversial. But yeah, as Barbara points out, he gave Ananda a very tough time. One thing I didn't talk about with Ananda, which is worth honoring him for, is that he was instrumental in convincing the Buddha to allow women to ordain.
I've heard a theory that Ananda is a she. Was a woman.
Well, okay, I'm going to say something. I wrote a book.
I got to get my exercise.
And it's dealing with that issue. That Ananda, don't tell Brenda, was actually the Buddha's first wife. I mean, his wife. And that, anyway, if you want to read the book, I'm hopefully going to get it out in the next couple of years.
Oh, good. It explains a lot of the problems that Ananda went through, doesn't it?
And how they had the weird theory of the Buddha's unenlightened attendant managing to convince him to ordain women, because he did. Was it not for Ananda, women would not have been ordained. So it is an interesting theory.
But one way or the other, we owe a great deal to Ananda and his or her memory. Any other comments? Maybe we can do meta and get out of here early. Oh, thank you.
Delightful.